Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Castle Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
I'm glad to hear it. I want to comment on something. I've been working behind the bar at Catherine Lombardi, training the bartenders, because we have a pretty serious cocktail program. And one of the things, you know.
The serious cocktail program, one of the things that it entails is it does take a lot of extra training. You can't take somebody and just put them back there and tell them to practice a couple of drinks and have them kind of acclimated to that in short order. It takes a greater degree of difficulty there.
I think there's also a big difference and we as a society look at a bartender differently than we look at a waiter. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of it has to do with you're more on a level to level, that bartender being behind the bar, bartender usually has access to the phone, bartender's in charge of the money, and the bartender...
You know what? There's something else that a bartender gets to do that a waiter never gets to do. A bartender sometimes, by law, by decree, must say no. A waiter really never says no. Maybe the maitre d' comes over and says no.
Right. The waiter is under the same obligation not to serve a person who's had too much. But the way a waiter handles it is a waiter goes and gets the maitre d'. The maitre d' or the manager comes over and cuts you off. If you're at a bar and you've had too much, the bartender cuts you off. But also, there's another thing that the bartender is responsible for. Look, you're at a table in the dining room. Unless you're hooting and hollering and yelling, your interaction is with the people at your table. At a bar, your interaction is very often with the people next to you, with the other people in the room, with the bartender.
And there's some expectation that if you're going to sit at a bar, certainly by yourself, that you're probably, you know, going to talk to somebody.
Well, it's certainly not rude if you're sitting at a bar to say hello to the person next to you or strike up a conversation.
Where if you're sitting in a dining room and somebody's two tables away, you usually
like, hey, you, how's it going? Nice tie.
Hey, how's the pasta fuzzle tonight?
that's wrong. But one of the things that comes with that is the bartender is sort of the in charge of the social interaction. And even if you're not drunk, I mean, we've banned people from our bars when we were bartending for other people. Remember that guy who used to talk to every pretty girl? We used to call him the windshield wiper.
We're not going to say he talked to every pretty girl. We're going to say he talked to every girl.
He was really annoying, and he was a nice enough fellow, but he didn't have a good sense of personal space.
Or propriety. He was improprietous.
And he didn't read body language well. So people would be like, okay, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Like, they'd say, oh, hello, how are you? How are you? Fine. What's your name? Mary. I'm from where? Okay, that's good. And, you know, someone would turn away, and they'd give him the shoulder a little bit. And it wouldn't stop him. He'd be like, oh, and so where'd you go to high school?
Tap on the shoulder that they've just turned towards him.
And he was just annoying, you know? And so we'd be at the bar, and he was, again, he didn't really cross a line specifically for any one thing. He didn't drink too much. He didn't kiss somebody that didn't want to be
kissed. But he didn't have a sense of decorum, and he needed that sense.
And he was deaf to the bar, because a bar works. You know, a couple of people wander in, bartender keeps them happy, then somebody else wanders in, and they find somebody to talk to. And I'm not talking about a sports bar or a bar with a lot of televisions. I'm talking about a nice bar.
Right, a community bar.
So this guy we called the windshield wiper, because he'd sit at the bar, and he'd sit next to somebody and start talking to them. They'd get up and leave. He'd move one seat down, and then start talking to the person next to them. Then they'd get up and leave in 15 minutes. And then he'd work his way down the bar, and you'd be empty. And if for some reason the bar had filled in behind him, he'd work his way back the other way.
Much like a windshield wiper. The only problem is, after a while, it would stop raining.
Yeah. Okay. So people would walk by, and we'd see people walk in the door. They'd see he was sitting there. They'd turn around. They'd walk out. Now, listen, bartenders work on tips. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah, it doesn't take you long to fix this problem.
And it was a heartbreaking conversation I had to have this guy, because he was just a lonely guy.
Actually, I remember when you had the conversation.
Oh, I felt terrible.
I remember the incident, and you may not remember the
incident. I know what you're... What I did was I had a conversation with a guy, and I said, listen, when people don't want to talk to you, you need to take a hint and just have your drink, and if people want to talk to you, they won't turn their back to you. When someone turns their back to you,
the conversation's over.
Now, listen, I'm a lot meaner than I am. I'd be like, you, Tinker Bell, out the door. Out you do go, right?
True to door, true to window.
But so I had this conversation with him, and he's like, really? And he really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work out, and we eventually, like a month later, I had to ban him. I said, listen, you can't come back to the bar anymore. So Mark didn't tell you the story.
But the story that he told was he stopped
talking to everybody, so it sort of built up. His tensions built up, I guess.
He really didn't take a hint from someone. And then, right during one of these conversations when somebody turned his back to them, he leaned over and gave them a little peck on the cheek from kind of...
No, it wasn't on the cheek. He gave her, I remember it was Linda, he gave her a peck on the lips. And Linda could have kicked the tar out of this guy. I don't know if you recall.
I do remember.
He was a little squirrely guy, and Linda was like buff, and he's lucky she didn't haul off and whack him.
Yeah, you by asking him to leave the bar, you saved his life.
Right, no, well, he kissed her goodnight is what happened, and he walked out. And so... And she turned, and I didn't see it. And she said, "That little squirrely guy just kissed me on the lips." I was like, "I'm sorry. I'll buy you a drink. It'll never happen again." And the next time he came back in, I had to say, "Listen, man, I can't serve you here anymore." Mm-hmm. And he looked so hurt.
Yeah, puppy dog.
I was like, "He's like, what do you mean?" I was like, "You kissed. Remember that woman you kissed?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "She didn't want you to kiss her, man. Yeah. I can't have the mad kisser at my bar. You're not allowed back in the bar anymore." And I felt bad. He was a nice enough fellow. He just didn't have that sense of propriety. But as the bartender, listen, I can't have an empty bar because I'm being nice to you.
It's my property. I have a sense of propriety.
Yeah, exactly. In my property. And that was when we were working for somebody else. But I remember when we opened Stage Left. Do you remember this? We were at Stage Left about 3 years goes by, 2 years goes by. We open our own restaurant in the same town, and he comes into the bar one day about 6 months after we're open.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked up to him. I didn't say a word, and I walked up to him with this like look of apology on my face, but hadn't gotten a drink yet, and I waved off the bartender to not, you know, we have the owner signals. We're like Rick in Rick's Cafe Americana in Casablanca.
Everything means something. Everything I say, everything I do has a secret meaning.
I gave the old little finger thing. It means he's not getting a drink. And I walked over, and he looked at me, and he said, "Here too?"
Actually, what you said at that point was, "Actually, you can go back to the other place now." That's really not an issue. But here, your money's no good.
Yeah, that was really sad.
Your money's no good, as it were.
Mm. You know, and the other funny bar story I recall is...
The other funny bar story. Like we only have three. That's it. Okay. You come in, you talk to us, three funny bar stories. Then we got to leave because it's over.
You and I were in the office. And we got the call. Listen, there's this guy at the bar. I cut him off. I got to throw him out. He won't leave. I'm like, all right, I'll go take care of it. And so Mark's doing his paperwork. And I come up. And I'm like, listen, man, bartender cut you off. You got to go. It's like the afternoon. He's like, oh, yeah? Who's going to make me? And, of course, me. I'm the little guy. I'm like, Kyle, call Mark in the office, please. And so what he says is, oh, what's Mark? The big Italian guy you keep in the basement to throw people out? And I said, yeah. And so Mark came up from the office, and this guy was pretty big, and he walks over, and Mark's walking over to him, and he says, "Ah, who are you, the big Italian guy that came in the basement to throw people out?" And you said,
"Yeah." At least that's what I am today.
And then Mark bellied him out the door. Now, the bellying someone out the door is like you got to spread your arms wide, and you don't raise your hand, and it's not confrontational, but you sort of just, you keep walking toward the door, and you gather them.
You keep walking, and you kind of do a little like the guy's an umpire, and you're slowly bumping into him and letting him back his way out of the restaurant.
Out the door, you
And off
go.
He went.
I'm so glad New Brunswick is such a nicer neighborhood now.
Things have changed a lot. No bellying anybody out the door anymore.
Not in a long time. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment with Kim Severson in the New York Times. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Kim Severson. She writes for The New York Times. She writes some great articles for The New York Times. I have to be honest, we steal ideas from Kim Severson all the time, so we figured it would be a good time to invite her to join us on the show. Hi, Kim.
Hi, great to be here, guys.
Welcome to the show.
The most recent article that you wrote that really caught our eye that I thought was an important article, in a number of ways, and it was more than just on the surface, which is what I like about how you write. You wrote extensively about the joy of cooking, the most recent edition of The Joy of Cooking. Why is the joy of cooking important, and where did it start, and why is that the cookbook? If you know one cookbook, everybody knows the joy of cooking.
Right. So far, there's been about 18 million copies of The Joy of Cooking.
That'd be a lot.
It's a lot of cookbooks. And, you know, it started in 1930 when the original author, Irma Rombauer's husband, committed suicide. This is a cheery little side note to
oh
your show.
Oh, my God.
Sorry. So to console herself, she started writing a cookbook and writing recipes, and she self-published it, and there were about, I think, 3,000 of the first copies sold. And then it grew. It obviously was at a niche at that time. It grew. Her daughter took up the cause, Marion Rombauer Becker, and her daughter's husband also, who was quite literary. So they started this book, and, you know, if anybody's read The Joy of Cooking, it's got all these little folksy little head notes and side items. But the thing that I think is enduring about The Joy of Cooking is it has all kinds of things in it. And as I point out, it can tell you how to purify water and how to make a gimlet, both of which are valuable in cases of emergency.
So
just about anything you need to know is in the book, and it's the book that is probably most likely to be given out at a when someone gets married or when someone leaves home. So The Joy of Cooking is one of those books that when you're editing out your shelf, you always throw it in the, you know, in the box when you're moving. It stays with you. So it's really it's become quite iconic, I think, for people who cook and even for people who don't cook. There's, you know, if you have no idea how to make pancakes, say you wanted to make from scratch pancakes, it's in there. You want to make basic chocolate chip cookies. You can really find just about anything.
I mean, this is a book that was on my grandmother's shelf that mm-hmm. she would occasionally use. This mm-hmm. is a book that was on my mother's shelf that she would occasionally use. This is a book that's on my wife's shelf. Well, she doesn't cook, so she never uses it.
But she would
use it if she ever cooked.
Okay.
He's in so much trouble.
God, I'm like, do you like the doghouse?
Oh my God, is he in trouble?
I spend a good deal of time there. It's kind of comfy. I've set up a little bed in there.
Nice. I think the thing about The Joy of Cooking, and it's on my shelf, it's when I want to, and I've sort of gotten better over the years, but I remember when I was, I don't know, you know, in my early 20s, and I would want to be experimenting with, you know, roasting a piece of meat or Mark's looking at me like,
Francis scared me. He said experimenting in his early 20s. I didn't know where he was going.
Yeah, right. We all did.
Well,
okay.
but this is with the cooking, though.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, how long to roast a piece of meat? How many degrees per pound? How do you figure that mm-hmm. stuff out?
Mm-hmm.
But it's more than just a reference book. It's taken on, like you said, an iconic place in the American kitchen. But it's changed over the years. And it changed drastically in 1997, and now we already have a big rewrite with the recent version now.
Right.
Will you talk to us about how it changed in 97?
It's a little confusing. In fact, I was curious about, do you know which edition you have on your shelves? Do you have an idea how long you've had it?
I've had it since the early 80s.
Yeah, okay. So
yeah.
You probably have the big revision. Well, there are a few. There's one that happened in 1963 that a lot of people have. The ones that are older than that are still around, but they're more collector's items, or maybe an elderly aunt might have it on her shelf. The one in 63, a lot of people's parents have.
That's all my mother has.
Right, and that was a big rewrite. The one that I ended up getting, and that sounds like you have, was in 1975. That's when the next
mm-hmm,
rewrite
yes.
came, and they talk some about, it's kind of funny. There's, this sort of talk about this potential microwave cookery, and there's these sort of, so there's not a lot of talk about saturated fat or trans fats, or the whole health thing hadn't kicked in. In fact, there's a long discussion about rendering lard and clarifying fats without all of the sort of health discussion that happened mm-hmm. in the
these,
80s. So it's kind
these
of
these are a few of my favorite things.
Right,
yeah.
Thank you. Fats and cooking. Fat
uh-huh.
fat is good. So it's it's an interesting, you know, cheese. The whole American cheese thing hadn't quite happened when the 75 book was written. So you don't have a long discussion about how to put together a cheese board or you know, discussions of cow's milk cheese versus sheep's milk. So it's interesting that the things that aren't in the 75 edition, although it's still a very solid book, and it's the one that I have on my shelf.
Well, I think the thing about the 75 edition, we've talked about what's not in that one that's in later editions. What did they take out of the 75 edition that had been in the 63?
This is what's interesting, that I think 75 it's a little bit updated. There's a little bit more convenience things. There's a lot more canned soup. Although there were canned soups, condensed canned soups in 63, those kinds of convenience foods and recipes that use those convenience foods, packaged cream cheese, things that were a little more popular in the 70s. Now, in 97, that's when the big shocker hit. 97, the book was rewritten, and it was the whole first-person tone, we and the Rombauer family did this and that, all that was taken out. It was written in a third-person kind of tone, and the editor at the time hired all kinds of chefs and food experts to rewrite chapters. So
I want to come back and talk about this big change that has now sort of in a way been undone with the new release of the Joy of Cooking. I've heard the 97 version of the Joy of Cooking be referred to as the new Coke era of the of the Joy of Cooking. We're talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times about the Joy of Cooking, one of the most iconic cookbooks in the American kitchen. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see. You need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Half of Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Kim Severson. She writes for the New York Times. She's also written The Trans Fat Solution, Cooking and Shopping to Eliminate the Deadliest Fat from Your Diet. And she joins us today. We're talking about The Joy of Cooking, which has just gone through a major rewrite. Now, what happened with the 97 version of The Joy of Cooking? They changed the tone of it, but they also dropped a lot of the old homey family recipes out of it.
Right. A lot of people were quite outraged. Canning was gone. The entire chapter on homemade ice cream was gone. Pickling was greatly reduced. One of my favorite things were that you could learn how to skin a squirrel or simmer a porcupine in the old books. Those were gone. This was the era of the chef. If you'll remember when this book was getting written in the mid-90s, the celebrity chef was quite the thing, and most home cooks were getting really hopped up on restaurant culture. And so that really is reflected in this book. So you don't have as much of the homey things. You have a lot more. There's, in fact, a whole chapter, for example, on small plates, which is sort of funny. It's a little bit of a culinary trend that's getting a little frayed around the edges now. But at the time, boy, that was the thing. So you'll see in the 97 book there's that kind of a restaurant influence. People were outraged by this book, some people were, because it lost some of the homey tone. It's written, like I say, in a very third-person thing. I think this is a great book, though. I think the recipes are much more sophisticated. There's more ethnic diversity in the recipes. There's some really brilliant chapters. You know, Corby Cummer's a food writer for The Atlantic Monthly. He did a great chapter on coffee and tea that was just a very deep and brilliant study of the subject. A lot of people felt like they didn't need to have the intellectual depth that this book had necessarily. On the other hand, it's a really great, great book and very sophisticated, but boy, it was very controversial, and it came out and people were really outraged. Their homey little Joy of Cooking was gone. For people a little bit more sophisticated, it's a great reference, and I think sort of got a bad rap.
Yeah,
Coke, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. I found it ironic, though, that they removed the canning section kind of right before it became in vogue to can again.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Kind of
funny?
Before we all got back into
it. Well, but there's been a rewrite recently about The Joy of Cooking that's just been released, and it restores some of the great things from the past, and maybe it restores a little bit too much. We're going to talk more about that with Kim Severson of the New York Times. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Capitol Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us at restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Kim Severson. She writes for the New York Times, where she writes some of our favorite articles on food and cooking and the like. And we're talking today about cookbooks, specifically about the joy of cooking. I like to collect old cookbooks, and I have a number of cookbooks. One of my favorite, back to the 1800s, you know, Amelia Simmons cookbook from 1896. We celebrated her 100th anniversary of the publication of her cookbook, which is the first American cookbook in 1996. We did a menu with that. My favorite cookbooks that I have is there's a whole series of Bachelor cookbooks that came out in the 60s and 70s.
Nice.
And the Esquire cookbook has two pieces of advice, one of which is very good and one of which is very bad. The one good piece of advice is a single man should always have a bottle of champagne chilled and ready to go, just in case, in the refrigerator. And the other is, of course, that a can of mushroom soup on top of everything works to make a sauce.
How'd that work for you?
The champagne, great.
I'm going to say he's still a bachelor. How's that?
So, Kim, in The Joy of Cooking in 1997 was edited. We edited out the hominess and the hokiness and sadly, a lot of the canning recipes and the ice cream recipes. Now, and there was a lot of hue and cry about that. And now there's a brand new version of The Joy of Cooking out, which you wrote about in the New York Times. Tell us about the most recent edition of The Joy of Cooking. Good or bad? Give us the poop.
Okay. Well, now Scribner, the publisher, wants you to spend $30 to buy their new 75th anniversary Joy of Cooking. And you probably are thinking, okay, I've got one, maybe two on my shelves. Do I need another one? And the real difference in this book is that Ethan Becker, who is the son of Marion Rombauer Becker, who's the daughter of the original author, has taken over, and it has the sort of the carrier of the Becker, of the Rombauer Becker Joy family tradition. And he's kind of he's a little bit of a country bon vivant. He cooks a lot. I don't think he considers himself a great cook, but he is in charge now of the Joy of Cooking empire. He felt like the 97 edition got away from him. He felt a little bullied by New York publishers. It was chefed up, and now he and his family are reclaiming the joy. And so they've just infused this thing with all of this kind of kitschy, homey, it's almost like postmodern, ironic, sense of dishes. There's something called shrimp wiggle, which is kind of a warm shrimp cream sauce dish that's put on toast. It really is not an appealing dish at all. He's reinstated the old, Becker family borscht, three-can borscht, where there's a story in the book about how they keep a can of beets, a can of cream of chicken soup, and a can of beef bouillon in the refrigerator. So at any time when guests drop by, you can
scare them to death.
kill end the party. And I made a batch of this up, and trying to get people to taste it, and they really did. It looked like a raspberry smoothie, and it just tasted like like a chemistry student's homework. And so these kinds of recipes are put back in the name of bringing back the hominess. And I really do think they went a little overboard, and the marketing for it is all like, the best loved joy is back, and it's just kind of cloying. And I'm sorry that they put so much of that in. Now, on the other hand, they did restore canning. They did restore the huge ice cream chapter. The venison chapter is much better than it was in the 97 book. And there's things about like the old joy that I like in it. And it is a more up-to-date book. So I don't want to say it's not the book to get, but you have to kind of read past
the shrimp on toast,
shrimp wiggle to get to the good stuff. It's funny. It's a really interesting study in marketing. And I think for most people who just want to know what darn book I ought to get, it's a little confusing.
Does it really wiggle?
It doesn't wiggle, and I have no idea. It just kind of lays there, and I saw no wiggling. I think people are just in love with the name Shrimp Wiggle, and you call anything wiggle, I think it's gonna work. That may even be in your Bachelor cookbook.
I'm sure.
I also think in this day and age, we have a whole slew of ingredients that were not available to us 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to include that in the discussion. And really, you don't ever need to put a can of, and I'll say their name, Campbell's soup, into one of your recipes. You just don't need to do that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think increasingly as we realize what we put in our bodies matters, and it doesn't have to taste bad, but it ought to be something, you know, the movement toward locally grown food, toward food that's, you know, that is just that just tastes better because it was grown with more care. Even people who are average cooks understand that, and you don't need to go to the cream of mushroom soup anymore, even if it's for nostalgia's sake. I just don't think it's necessary.
Just because it's from the past doesn't mean it was good in the past.
No, that's right. Grandma wasn't so nice all the time.
Like great-grandma didn't do that. Well, great-grandma looked at grandma doing that.
Okay, let me help you guys with something.
Grandma made a stock, you know. She ran an efficient kitchen, and the scraps that were left over she made into a stock, and it's not that hard to do. So it's really been interesting. You know, I had four copies of The Joy of Cooking through the ages, you know, on my dining room table, and I started to read them and cook and figure out which was which, and it was a really interesting couple of weeks. It made me appreciate that cooking does take a long time. You know, we all fall back on those dishes we know how to make, and then we can kind of get out on Tuesday night pretty easily. It really made me think about how nice it is to spend a few hours making something in the kitchen and what a kind of satisfying Sunday that can be. And then it also made me realize that you know, people can spend a lot of money on cookbooks, and you don't need them. So,
well, you talk about the marketing. You know, how long do we have until we have the bound set of The Joy of Cooking with all the different versions?
The greatest hits of Joy of Cooking. William Shatner does The Joy of Cooking. It can go on forever.
The Joy of Cooking on CD.
Exactly.
No, I think, though, that one thing that Mark and I harped on was it's great that the canning section is back, because Mark and I have gotten more and more into that. And actually, in our restaurants, we get more into it, because as you try and eat locally, look, we're in the Northeast and we're very seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
And put up tomatoes are great, mm-hmm. and they're better 6 months
and
down the road.
And they make better tomato sauce, and they make better
you
know, gravy, and they just do.
And so, and I don't think that takes a very long time, and I think canning is really, really tremendous art to practice.
You know, the strawberries on the cheese board in January that have been preserved are spectacular.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And even just knowing how to, like, freeze strawberries so you could pull them out and do something with them in the middle of winter. And we're all going to the farmer's markets more, and the green markets, and you come home, you know, or maybe you belong to one of those community-supported agriculture things, and you have this big box of vegetables, and you don't know what to do with it, but it's a few simple preservation tricks, and you know you have a much, much better winter, that's for sure. And it's not that hard to do, you know.
The other thing that I saw that you wrote about in this Joy of Cooking is that it has a, what you call a very solid cocktail section.
Right.
Now I think that is reflective of what's going on in cuisine, and then the place of cocktails, the resurgence of cocktails in the American kitchen and the American diet. Is that, do you agree with that?
I think there is a resurgence. I think if you go eat at people's houses, you know, you go to friends, some people will have a house cocktail for the winter or one thing they're doing, and it's kind of a nice little icebreaker. And it's not like let's all make martinis anymore. It's just something a little more thoughtful, something maybe reflects the region. People are making Sazeracs, you know, after what happened in New Orleans. It's kind of a, you sort of feel like it's your duty-bound honor to serve a cocktail that's, maybe supports our brothers and sisters in New Orleans, so you make a Sazerac. I think there's a appreciation of that, and there's an appreciation for people who are good bartenders.
Well, and I think that people, what you're seeing, as you say, we are celebrity chef-driven, but you're seeing bartenders like my friend Dale DeGroff or Audrey Saunders at the Pegu Club or Sasha Petraski.
They're becoming celebrities all on their own.
Well, and they're doing it by applying the same principles that we do to cooking to cocktails, balance, ingredients, freshness. And I celebrate that. I think that's tremendous.
Right. Infusing things like ginger syrups and doing thoughtful combinations and, you know, cucumber juices and that sort of thing. I think it's very interesting. Overall, all of our palates are improving all the time, and people have a really good sense of what tastes better. You know, you look at the gourmet coffee thing, and people now understand differences in coffee. They're starting to understand differences in chocolate. They understand differences in bread. Even somebody who's not what you would consider one of the elite eaters, but you look at a grocery store, and they'll have two or three different kinds of sort of bakery fresh bread. People all across the board are learning what tastes good,
and that comes from you guys out there. You keep Kim Severson and Mark and I employed, but you also are having better and better taste all the time and bringing more and more great stuff on the market. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Kim about Brooklyn-style pizza, whatever the heck that is. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space.
Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're having a lovely conversation today with Kim Severson of the New York Times. We were talking about the joy of cooking. If you want to find out more information about the new version of the joy of cooking, which is very different than prior versions of the joy of cooking, you can look up Kim's article of the New York Times at nytimes.com. And if you want to find out how to pick up the joy of cooking, you can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
Kim, I got to tell you, I'm watching, and you just wrote an article on Brooklyn-style pizza, and I'm watching the Domino's commercial, and that's the big thing that they're broadcasting now.
Mark, your family's from Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
You're Italian, right?
Yeah.
You eat well, right?
Yes.
What's Brooklyn-style pizza?
I have no clue. Okay. I'm telling you that I spend a lot of time in Brooklyn nearly every Sunday.
They made it up.
And they come on, and this commercial comes on, and it's the Brooklyn-style pizza, and I turn to my wife, I'm like, what's Brooklyn style pizza?
can I share with you, Kim? I don't know if you know this, but Catherine Lombardi is our second restaurant. It's named after Mark's grandmother because it's her cuisine. She was Italian American, not Italian, and we call it Brooklyn Italian.
Right.
It's a Brooklyn Italian restaurant. We own a Brooklyn Italian restaurant.
Right.
We don't know what Brooklyn style pizza is. You're a New York Times reporter. You're an investigative reporter.
Right.
What's Brooklyn style pizza?
Help us.
I tried to blow the whole lid off of this thing. I got, you know, we at the New York Times like to deeply investigate all of the important social issues of our time. This being, I think, one of the most important. What the heck is a Brooklyn style pizza? And, you know, Pete Wells is our new editor at the paper. Just, he was a food and wine columnist and editor at Details, and he just came on as our dining editor, and he's a terrific guy and has written a lot about pizza. So he came in one morning and said, did you see this commercial? Look at that. We were looking online, and he said, what is Brooklyn-style pizza?
The commercial, by the way, for everyone, if you don't know, is Domino's is now selling a Brooklyn-style pizza.
Hey, forget about it.
Yeah, and it's got every stereotype in the world. It's like, you know, like I said, they went to the Brooklyn stereotype store, and they have the Italian woman yelling out of the brownstone. They got the cab driver of some kind of vague foreign descent being kind of like clueless, and they have, you know, the African-American guy, and he's talking, but you can't hear him because his, you know, rap music from the speakers in his car is too loud.
I got to tell you, I'm hard to offend.
Yeah.
I was offended.
I mean, it's just like, my God. And so anyway, so that day we ordered up a pizza to the newsroom, a Domino's-style, Brooklyn-style, or Domino's Brooklyn-style pizza, and couldn't figure out, it actually, and my buddies at nyslice.com tried it, and it really is for a Domino's pizza, it's better than a lot of them. What they do is take basically a 12 or 14 inch crust and then stretch it out so it's a couple inches bigger. So, you know, what they might use for a medium pie, they stretch out for a large pie. So the crust is
thinner.
So we've
got a thin crust pizza.
It's got some cornmeal on it for a little crunch. They use a mix.
Cornmeal in Brooklyn?
Thank you.
What? Cornmeal? No, they should call it an Ohio pizza.
I'm just the messenger, my friend.
Okay. All right, I'm sorry.
And they put provolone and mozzarella on it. So anyway, we thought, well, okay, let's take this into the heart of it all. We went and bought a Domino's pie a couple blocks away on Neptune Avenue and brought it to Totono's, which I think is really one of the stalwarts of a good pizza.
And they almost threw you out when you walked into the Domino's.
I don't know if you know Cookie, who's the owner. Her husband ran it for a long time. And anyway, we walked in with this. First of all, my favorite thing is that when we bought the pizza at the Domino's in Brooklyn, the most Brooklyn thing about it was that they handed it to us over bulletproof glass. I thought, now this, Domino's could recreate this Brooklyn experience, they'd be doing fine. Anyway, we walked in with this pizza, and she just immediately, she's like, get that out of here. What are you doing? She's like, it's dog food. What are you doing bringing that in my place? So we're like, no, I'm a reporter. And I'm like, oh. So anyway, so she said, you want a pizza? I'll make you pizza. So they made us up a couple, and then we tasted them side by side and looked at them and thought about them. And, you know, it's just amazing. And this is why I encourage anybody, anything you're interested or you think is good, taste it next to something else of a similar thing. I mean, I don't care if it's a brand of seltzer you're drinking or a kind of cheese, but when you do side-by-side comparisons, boy, you really can start to articulate the differences. And it was like, I mean, I cannot tell you the difference. It was astounding how, you know, by itself, the Domino's pizza, we were in the newsroom, we were hungry, it was lunch, you know, okay, well, whatever, it's, you know, takeout pizza. Compared to the real thing, it was almost inedible.
Well,
to us. You can't believe it.
I mean, look, if you're in Ohio and you're not from around New York and you think Domino's is good pizza, I'm sorry.
You just lost all your listeners in Ohio.
I'm sorry. We do have listeners in the Midwest.
But seriously.
Madison, Wisconsin, the big hub for us.
Okay, you're in an area that doesn't really have pizza and all you have is this mass-produced pizza. Okay, I get it. I understand.
But that's how people in Brooklyn eat.
But I'll never forget. I came to college in New Brunswick, okay, and I'm from North Jersey originally, and people are ordering in New Jersey Domino's pizza into the dorm.
Whatever for.
And I'm thinking, what are you doing? Live in New Jersey. There's no reason to order a Domino's pizza.
I have a quote from your article where you quote Dana Harville of Domino's. She said, when you're trying to get her to say, what the heck is a Brooklyn pizza? And she says, I'll try to imitate her voice. We found that Brooklyners like to eat their pizza differently. They like floppy large slices and they fold them into almost a sandwich.
Yeah, she's just, I mean, you got to understand, I just imagine, and for some, you know, God bless her, I'm sure, but I just imagine these, you know, marketing people are, you know, whatever, 25, 30 years old, just out of marketing school, and she's just so bouncy and enthusiastic, and she kept calling them, I think she kept calling them Brooklyners.
Yeah, oh, they're
here. I was just like, you know, and she's like, Brooklyn has a big personality. We're really having fun with it. And I just was like, okay.
You need to be dropped off in Brooklyn like midnight somewhere and beaten.
You just have a lot of fun with it then, right, sweetie.
Because you have no idea what it is.
Right, and, you know, and it was very funny. Cookie at Totono's was like, yeah, well, in Utah they'll love this. They have ketchup and American cheese on their pizzas. But it's that co-opting of a culture. You know, it's just the nature. It's the culture we live in that we in the newspaper business, and you guys too. And you know, you make broad strokes and generalizations of that.
Yeah, but
thing.
This is fiction.
And this is fiction, and they're going to make a lot of money off it. I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that it's going to work. But boy, it's offensive on a number of levels.
You know, hold on one second, Kim. We have to break for commercial. We'll be right back with Kim Severson of the New York Times talking about Brooklyn-style pizza, whatever the heck that is. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi. And we're talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times about Brooklyn-style pizza. And we have to bring another personality into this. Mark, you and I went out to dinner when Arthur Schwartz was talking at the 92nd Street Y with Gail Green, and we had dinner with Gail Green afterwards. And Arthur's a great food personality. He's been on the radio. He's written about food for a long time. And he may be responsible for creating...
You got to tell this story.
I was writing a story, and then Arthur had just gotten back from Italy. He's researching a new book. So I call him because I think, okay, he's written a great book called New York City Food. If anyone knows what Brooklyn-style pizza is, it's him. I call him up. I'm like, Arthur, what's going on? What's Brooklyn-style pizza? And I explain to him the story. He's like, oh, no. I'm like, what? He's like, oh. He goes, you know, last year I consulted with Domino's for about a day, and, you know, and I said, oh, you're kidding. He said, no. He goes, I didn't know they were doing this. I did suggest the cornmeal on the crust. And then he just felt terrible. As I was like, I'm like, Arthur, how could you have done that? And he just was like, I'm sorry. If I'm responsible for this, I'm terribly sorry. He was just like, oh, I had no idea what they were going to do. He's so funny. And I think he made maybe $1,000 for a day of consulting. But I said, you know, was it worth it now?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Burrow. Can't stand you. But he was just terribly apologetic. And he's a great guy. And I really respect his research. He's one of those great, you know, smart cookbook authors who knows a lot about Italian food and Brooklyn food, and he was just, I think ruined his whole morning with my phone call.
I think the heart of the matter here is Brooklyn pizza and Domino's really have nothing to do with
each exactly,
other.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really the heart of this
matter.
And
it's not Arthur Schwartz's fault. Arthur, we don't hold you responsible. We still love you.
And don't put cabs in the commercials in Brooklyn. Most of them take car service. Quit it.
My point, I'm like, I have not. I mean, you know how hard it is to find a cab in Brooklyn?
Yeah, I know.
And they're actually giving away a free cab as part of the promotion. I'm like, what the? Anyway.
Just for those of you who don't live around here, in Brooklyn, you don't hail taxis on the street. That's Manhattan. In Brooklyn, you call a car service. Domino's doesn't know anything about Brooklyn. and they don't know anything about pizza, but they do know a lot about making money, and we'll leave it at that, and they should do what they do best. But if you've got a real pizzeria owned by a local guy near you, order it from him.
Kim, thanks so much for being with us.
We have to leave it at that. Thanks a lot, Kim.
Big fun, guys. Thanks.
That's Kim Severson of the New York Times. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.